I'm very happy to welcome you to our 2020 speaker series featuring Leoni Reeves, president of the Oregon State Bar. Ramon Hernandez, our managing partner in Oregon, will be leading the discussion today with Leoni, and we look very much forward to hearing what she has to say. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ramon Hernandez for our discussion today with Leoni Reeves. Ramon?
Thank you very much, Linda. It is a great pleasure for us to have Leoni Reeves address us today. For those of you who are just meeting Leoni, I want you to know that I've known her for almost 20 years and have been impressed with her leadership in the legal profession. She is currently a shareholder at Bullard Law, where she practices employment law. Prior to that, she had some very key leadership roles within state government that we'll talk a little bit more about. And in addition, currently, Leoni is serving as president of the Oregon State Bar Association. And Leoni, thank you very much for taking the time to address our firm. I know you're a very busy practitioner. So I'd like to just start off by asking some general background questions so that those people that are listening can learn a little bit more about you. Is that okay?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you.
You're welcome. So Leoni, are you a native Oregonian? And if not, when did you first come to Oregon?
I'm not a native Oregonian. So I was actually born in South Korea. And I'm one of the hundreds of thousands of adoptees who came over from South Korea. So I grew up in upstate New York until I was 12. And then I moved to rural Oregon, Coos Bay, Oregon, when I was 12 in 1988. And so, like many people, I'm a transplant. My parents chose to retire to Oregon from upstate New York.
And can you describe a little bit more about growing up in rural Oregon? I read an article in the Oregon State Bar in which you shared some experiences. Anything about that you want to share with the group today?
Yeah, I mean, I have a love for Oregon and rural Oregon because it is my home, but it was a very hard place to grow up as a young woman of color, young girl of color. I moved to Coos County in 1988, and Coos County at one point was a very thriving logging community. But by 1988, the logging community had, you know, the industry had declined, and there was just a lot of poverty and unemployment. There's a lot of anger from the community about, you know, all sorts of things, from the spotted owl to immigration. And just all sorts of reasons why a person of color being dropped into the middle of a very white, very rural Oregon community was not ideal for me. So it was really hard. I was bullied. In the 80s, we didn't really talk about bullying. It wasn't like part of our regular vocabulary the way it is today, but I certainly today can identify it as bullying. I got in lots of fights with other girls. I got suspended from school many times. And, you know, I had a really hard time fitting in there. I mean, I didn't fit in there, but it was definitely part of the experiences that sort of shaped me and pushed me to law school. But it was hard. It was really hard.
Well, thank you very much for your willingness to share that. You know, we're living in a day and age where there's a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment. So thank you very much for sharing that. We appreciate it. Leoni, were there lawyers in your family? You know, or how is it that you had decided to pursue a legal education?
I had lawyers in my extended family. You know, I'm adopted, so my parents are Caucasian, middle to upper class, came from middle to upper class backgrounds. I actually have a uncle who is a retired justice on the Minnesota Supreme Court. So in terms of the extended family, I definitely knew we had family lawyers in the family. My parents were both well-educated. They had careers other than law. And they weren't really the reason why I chose law. I chose law because of my experiences in Coos Bay and being just severely bullied and felt really powerless. I knew, at least from that earlier age, that being a lawyer, you could empower people. It was a way to sort of reclaim power that you didn't have maybe in other areas. And so I really wanted to go to law school to get a law degree so that I could have access to that type of power, have access to the justice system, you know, empower myself, empower others. And so it was really that experience in Coos County that sort of projected me into the law.
Thank you, Lonnie. And where did you choose to go to law school?
So I went to Willamette Law School, Willamette College of Law, which is in Salem, Oregon. I did my undergrad at Willamette as well. It's a tiny little liberal arts college in Salem, Oregon. And, you know, I got a full ride to both college and law school. So part of it was I enjoyed the Willamette community, but part of it was I knew that getting out of school with zero debt was going to open up doors for me. So I really did follow the money.
And you talked about growing up in rural Oregon, and Salem is a small town for people that don't know our geography and our you know, cities here. How did you find that experience going to undergrad and law school in Salem? Was the undergraduate student body, the law school student body, diverse? Did you meet friends, other friends that looked and sounded like you? What was that like?
I mean, the ironic thing, I guess, is because I grew up entirely in white neighborhoods, even in New York, we were in a very white neighborhood. My parents, my family is all white. I have an older brother who's also white. So I essentially grew up white, you know, in white communities and in white dominant culture. And Salem is not a diverse city by any objective measures, but for me, it was the first person where I actually saw other people of color, because Coos County had very few. And so my roommate in college was an exchange student from Japan. They had a large body of exchange students from Japan through a program, exchange university. And so Salem for me was actually like way more diverse than where I had come from, which people who know Salem think that's really funny. But the community that kind of took me in was the Hawaii Club. You know, I was kind of wandering around looking out of place my first week of school, and I look a little bit ethnically ambiguous. So somebody from Hawaii asked me if I was from Hawaii, and I said no. And they said, well, that's close enough, you know, come on down. So my first real experience with other people of color as my peer group was in college in the Hawaii Club.
And so you're in law school. What career path did you choose to pursue upon graduation? What were you looking for in the law?
Well, I think when I went to law school, I was really looking to get into public service. And while in law school, I got a lot of messages from my peers and from career services that I should go into a firm. So I applied to a firm, and I actually clerked at a firm in Portland during law school, and probably would have pursued that if I had been offered a job. However, I was not offered a job. They told me that I was well qualified and they liked me, but that if I wanted to do litigation, I was too passive to be a litigator. They just didn't think it was a good fit for me. And so they declined to make me an offer. So I got a job through the honors program at the Attorney General's Office for the State of Oregon. I sort of went back to why I had originally gone to law school in the first place, which was public service, and just stayed in public service for almost 15 years.
So you're deemed to be too passive, but what positions did you have there with the Oregon Attorney General? Can you describe the roles that you were serving, and what type of practice did you have?
Yeah, so the Attorney General's office, I was a defense civil litigator. So we were in the arm that did all of the defense of lawsuits against the state. I handled everything from constitutional challenges to state programs or state statutes. I handled, you know, wrongful death cases of people who were injured on state highways. I defended lawsuits against inmates or brought by inmates against prison guards. My very first case coming out of law school that I handled and took to trial, a bench trial, was a person who was in the Oregon State Hospital. It's our mental institution for people who have been deemed not able to stand trial. And so my first deposition was of a patient who was by definition not competent. So, I mean, it was a great place to get exposure to lots of different types of lawsuits on the civil side, and you know, the state gets sued for everything. So it was a great way to develop my litigation skills.
So you're in court a lot, you're doing trials, but yet it's ironic that that firm had this preconceived notion that you were too passive. That's, I find that very ironic. But Leonie, now I want to move on to a different experience that you've had, a different role that you've played. And I understand that you served as chief counsel to Oregon's governor. Is that correct?
That is correct. I worked for Governor John Kitzhaber for 4 years, an entirety of his third term in office.
And how does one go about becoming chief counsel? Not that I'm asking for myself, but there might be people that are wondering, like, well, how do you transition from being an attorney to being the lawyer for a state governor? How does that happen?
Well, for me, it just happened by accident. You know, it was not a job I applied for, but because I had worked in state government for a really long time, you know, I had achieved enough of a name recognition that when the governor, who was not a lawyer, so many governors are lawyers, so they have a large network of lawyers that they already know and draw from. My governor was a medical doctor by trade and didn't have a huge network into the lawyer community. So he actually asked the attorney general at the time, John Kroger, who was my boss, I guess, you know, for some recommendations of people who could serve as his legal counsel. And my governor had served as governor before. This was his third term as governor. He took 8 years off and then came back. He was strategically trying to build a team that looked different than his former team. So he didn't go back to, you know, his entire team that he had used before. So he was really looking for new people for his new administration. And so he asked the attorney general for some names. And I literally got a call from my boss, the attorney general, that said, "You have an interview with the governor this afternoon. Good luck. Go get it."
We're doing this interview as part of my firm's recognition of National Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. And I understand, is it true that you are the first Asian to serve chief counsel to Oregon's governor?
That is my understanding. Certainly, anecdotally and historically, the people that I know of, I don't think there's been another Asian that served. My deputy that I hired and that served with me was also Pacific Islander. He was Filipino, and I brought him in. And so we were probably the first two Asians that served in the legal counsel office.
Oh, great. Thank you for sharing that point with us. And how long did you serve as chief counsel to Oregon's governor?
4 years.
And what type of... I guess, what are the duties as somebody who serves as chief counsel? What types of matters were you involved in and decisions? Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I like to tell people that it's a job that nobody can really prepare for because the things that you do are so unique that it is the only position that does their job, those duties. So, and my duties were sort of in three different buckets. The first duty was, you know, legal work where I was advising the governor primarily on what was the scope of his authority as governor? Can he do this? Can he enact this program? Can he, you know, how do you interpret the statute with respect to his authority? So, you know, being a lawyer, advising him on public records issues, ethics issues, employment issues, and sort of scope of authority issues. The second big bucket was sort of programmatic things where it was, you know, the governor's constitutional or statutory duty to do something, and I ran that for him. So within our office, we did all the clemency petitions, so people who had been convicted of crimes who were asking for pardons or commutations of sentence. I worked with him on a very significant death penalty matter. We also did all the extradition warrants, so anything where prisoners were being extradited to and from the state, all of those ran through our office. And then the third big bucket was judicial appointments. The governor has constitutional authority to appoint judges who are where there's a vacancy midterm, and then the judges have to run to keep the seat. But over the course of 4 years, we appointed approximately 40 plus judges to Oregon's trial and appellate courts. So those are three big duties.
I want to talk a little bit more about that last job bucket you described of the judicial appointments. You've been practicing in Oregon a long time. How have you seen the judiciary change, or has it changed? Is it more diverse now than it was when you first started practicing? And did the role as chief counsel to the governor affect that?
So it's certainly more diverse than it was when I started practicing. You know, probably when I started practicing and when you started practicing in Oregon, I think we started about the same time, you know, you could sort of count the judges of color on one hand. We're now up to, I think, about 32 judges out of 193 identify as some kind of racial and ethnic minority, which is, you know, 16%, which is actually, you know, pretty good considering the numbers. And a lot of the appointments came from the last two administrations. Kate Brown, the governor, current governor, has appointed a number of attorneys of color into judicial positions. And then when I was in the governor's office, our administration appointed about 12 judges of color.
And what type of vetting, can you share the secret sauce on behind the scenes of vetting individuals to serve on the judiciary?
Sure. I mean, every governor does it a little bit different, but I think the process has looked a little bit the same for many years. So for our administration, we had a judicial screening panel of lawyers and sometimes judges, retired judges. The diversity and inclusion coordinator for the governor's office sat in and vetted candidates. So we would open a vacancy, accept applications. My deputy and I did the first round of screening. So we would sort of decide who was going to get an interview with the judicial screening panel. Then we would have that group of people in interview with the judicial screening panel, and they would sort of vet the candidates and decide who was going to interview with the governor. Anybody who interviewed with the governor went through an extensive background check by the Oregon State Police. They went around and talked to prior opposing counsel, prior lawyers. They talked to people's neighbors to see if there are any neighbor disputes, you know, how they are as a neighbor. So a fairly extensive and I'd say invasive background screening before anybody ever met with the governor. And then ultimately it's the governor's choice.
So you mentioned there was input from diversity and inclusion. Is it important? Was it important to you and to Governor Kitzhaber that there be a diverse judiciary in Oregon state courts?
It was important. I mean, obviously the first and foremost important criteria was, were they qualified to do the job? And then second of all, how were they gonna enhance the bench? So we were looking at how do you complement a court, you know, what kind of people and qualities or backgrounds and experiences does this court need? And we talked a lot when we were doing judicial appointments to the presiding judge and to other judges and attorneys who practice in those counties to talk about what tell us about the nature of your court, you know, what type of practice experience, you know, sort of missing from your bench. What does your community look like, the demographics of the community? Because I believe, and the governor believed, that to have legitimacy, your bench had to reflect your community. That doesn't mean that every person who comes to court is going to get a judge that looks like them, but it's going to be a courthouse that looks like the community that you come from. And so that was very much a value in looking at how are we going to be making these appointments.
Great, thank you for sharing that, Liani. So after 14 years in the government, different roles within the government, you transitioned to practice. What was transition like?
Yeah, I mean, it was really hard. And for people who don't know, and probably people in Oregon don't know, so my governor resigned under I'll just say a political scandal. And I was sort of tied up in the middle of it as his lawyer for 4 years. He was ultimately cleared of any criminal wrongdoing. I was certainly cleared of all wrongdoing. But it was a really hard exit from state government. I had served in that role or in state government for almost 15 years. And I literally got, you know, fired with zero notice just because of the political tides had changed. And so I always looked at that position as, you know, as a high risk, high reward position. And I had a ton of reward in that position and got to do amazing things. And I don't regret any second of it, but the risk was high, you know, as a political appointee at that level. So I got fired and I had to regroup. And I was really burnt out of politics, you know, because of the way my governor was treated, because of the way I was treated. And so I was done with state government, you know, and probably I was too politically tainted to be in state government. So I really targeted private firms and to sort of make that transition. You know, it's no secret to my firm that I would have never been in private practice but for this turn of events. You know, it wasn't anything that I was interested in before. So the transition for me was really hard because I had spent my entire career in public service. You know, the firm that I ended up going to has a lot of public clients. They have a long history of representing police departments, school districts, cities and counties, water districts, sewer districts. So the client base that I work with and the caseload and the clients that I have developed have largely been public service clients. So substantively, I'm still practicing the same type of law. But as you know, you all know, coming in private practice or being in private practice, it's a very different practice in terms of, you know, the bottom line for the firm, you know, making sure that, you know, you have billable work that's going to be, you know, collectible and that's going to be able to finance the firm and making decisions around a business. That's not how you practice law in the government. Certainly you're a steward of public funds, but when I practiced law in the government, the decision making was entirely around what is the public policy, what is the public interest, what is the right, you know, thing that we want to do for this particular governor's policy, and does that comply with the law? So just the way to practice law is much different. And the pressures in a private firm are way higher, you know, when your clients can hire and fire you. And so it's just a different set of pressures that I had to learn. And it was really hard for me to really add that additional lens of, okay, I'm still working with public clients, but how do I also make money for my firm? That was a really hard, challenging lens to sort of figure out how to add on to how I practice law.
And I know you've had various leadership roles within different specialty minority bars, but now you are leading the Oregon State Bar. And is it accurate that you're the first Asian American state president, bar president that we've had in Oregon?
Yes.
And what compelled you to pursue leadership within the Oregon State Bar? Why did you choose to do it? I can't imagine it's fun all the time. So why did you choose to pursue leadership?
You know, it was sort of a sense of duty. So as you alluded to, I had held leadership positions in the Oregon Asian Bar and the Oregon Minority Lawyers. So the affinity bars where I really felt a connection to the community in which that organization served. And I did it because it was my community, it was fun, it was my peer group, you know, it was just really rewarding personal service. I tell people that serving on the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors is it's not like sexy service, like you're not doing, you know, like sort of like this really fun stuff. It's really a grind, you know, it's getting through hundreds of pages of, you know, bylaw changes and, you know, the state bar budget and finance, the investment portfolio and, you know, disciplinary rules. It's really dense stuff. But it's really important. You know, it's important to lawyers what our roles are. It's important to lawyers how our license fees are being spent. It's important to the public because ultimately the mission of the Oregon State Bar is to protect the public and to build a legal system that protects them and works for them and is compliant with the rule of law. So it's really rewarding service as a lawyer, but it's not the funnest service, but it is extremely rewarding. And I did it because there's just not that many people who come from different backgrounds that do it. You know, historically, the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors and the presidents have been older white men, you know, sort of on their way out of practice, you know, because it takes up a huge amount of time. So they sort of attract a certain demographic. And that doesn't reflect what the Oregon legal community is today or should be, you know, reflective of today. And not many people who come from different backgrounds like mine and people of color, lawyers of color, have the opportunity to do that type of service. One, because they don't have the time and the resource to be able to commit that amount of, you know, time to it. And two, because they just haven't sort of broken into that inner circle of privilege and power that is traditionally the Oregon State Bar. And I was in a position that I could do it. So I felt like it was my duty to do it and to sort of set the example for other people of color, women of color, that they could do it too, and to really get into the inside and make sure that the decisions that the bar was making were reflective of diverse perspectives.
Leon, I thank you for sharing that. I want to ask a follow-up question regarding the diverse of the Oregon State Bar now, and I've been practicing almost 20 years. Has it changed Do you know the racial ethnic makeup of our state bar now, and how have you seen it change since you and I first started practicing almost 20 years ago?
Yeah, it has changed. It has not changed enough. And so I do have the statistics. So the bar today is 9.1% attorneys that have self-identified as, racial or ethnic minorities. That is disproportionate to the Oregon community at large, which is closer to 14%. That number has grown since we started. You know, it was definitely less than 9% when we started, but 9% is still too low. If you look at the disproportionality between our community and the legal profession. Some of the ethnic groups have stark contrasts between, you know, the amount of the community at large, like the Latino population in particular. There is a huge gap between the community demographics versus the legal profession demographics. It changes slowly. You know, I know when I did an ongoing presentation every year where I was looking at these statistics, and the number of Black or African-American attorneys like fluctuated between 99 and 101 every year, and everybody knew who left and who came. I mean, it's that small of a pool, right? And so we're now up to 133 Black or African-American attorneys. So there's definitely been progress, but that's still only 0.89% of the legal profession, as opposed to 2.2% of the Oregon population. So we have a lot of work to do.
And is the Oregon State Bar undertaking any efforts to address and increase the diversity in the legal profession? And if so, can you describe them?
Historically, the bar has really tried hard on diversity and inclusion, and Oregon is the only state in the nation that specifically assesses every member as part of their license fee, a diversity and inclusion assessment. So every lawyer pays an additional, I think it's at $35 now, that goes specifically to dedicated funding for diversity and inclusion. That's something that no other bars do, you know, and the Oregon State Bar has been doing it for, I think, 30 years. That money is used for programs like OLEO, which is a retention program for law students. It brings together law students from diverse backgrounds and really teaches them survival skills about, you know, if you don't have any other lawyers in your family, like, let's teach you the sort of the tricks and the secrets around what it really means to excel in law school and how to build a community so that you feel supported during that time. And so things like OLEO and really targeted at keeping law students in Oregon has been where a lot of those funds have gone. I'd say where we have a lot of improvement to go is on the retention of lawyers. We see a large sort of attrition problem where the people that are graduating from law school, their statistics just don't hold up, you know, 3 to 5 years out. So we have larger numbers of women and minorities graduating from our Oregon law schools, but, you know, they are leaving the state within 3 to 5 years. So really that retention piece is where we need a lot more, we just have a lot more to go. And we've been working on, Ramon, I think you've been working on the Leadership College. Thank you for your service on that. This is a new program that we're sort of targeting up and coming lawyers to develop leadership skills, to develop networking and community skills, to sort of keep them tied to the community and help them excel in positions so that they really feel like they're part of the community and can really pursue opportunities. So that's where I think we would like to do a little bit more. But there's definitely always more that we can do. We'll probably talk a little bit about the current situation that we're in, where we're doing this by webinar because everybody's in their homes. But that certainly impacted, you know, the overall financial ability of the bar to do any programs, let alone D&I programs. So,
well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about this COVID pandemic that we're in. And you're right, we're doing it via video instead of in our office in Portland. Folks are watching us via video. How has this pandemic affected the Oregon lawyers and the state bar and its functions and its programs?
Yeah, so I mean, the bar as an institution was able to pivot fairly quickly to remote work. I mean, there are a lot of things that the bar does, like the referral service for people in the community who are trying to be connected to lawyers. We had to figure out how to make those functions work remotely because those services had to continue. So as far as the operations of the bar, we were able to pivot to remote work environment. The bar staff is amazing and just was able to support that change. In terms of how it's impacted lawyers, I mean, you know, anecdotally, like I have had lawyers, because I am the bar president this year, I have had lawyers reach out to me, you know, in really dire situations. You know, people are being laid off. They are being people who's had job offers were rescinded. People are, you know, getting significant pay reductions. Law students are scared that they may not be able to take the bar exam. Oregon at this point is scheduled to go on with the July bar exam, but with a whole bunch of social distancing requirements, which is causing logistical, you know, challenges, but, you know, we're committed to making it work as long as we're legally able to do so under the current governor's executive orders at the time. So, I mean, there's definitely been a profound impact on lawyers and, you know, their livelihood. I'd say lots of lawyers who haven't been immediately impacted. So, for example, I'm an employment lawyer and, you know, my phone is ringing off the hook of people who are, you know, employers who need advice on, you know, how to get on, you know, unemployment for their employees and how to do layoffs and how to do reductions in force. But I also am working with companies that are laying off 90% of their staff. And are they going to be there in 30 to 60 to 90 days? I don't know. You know, I think a lot of the impacts to lawyers are going to be felt down the line because the clients that we serve are going to be really impacted by this as well. And so, you know, they're not going to be able to pay their lawyers for all that work that we did right now. So I think that there's going to be significant effects going forward as well once the clients that we work with may be having some financial difficulties. The other place where it's going to impact lawyers is there's going to be a huge increased legal need from the public for lawyers. And, you know, so the bar has been putting together some pro bono panels, you know, trying to recruit lawyers to create resources, videos, frequently asked questions on topics like bankruptcy, employment law, housing issues, because we know that there's going to be a huge amount of people in our community that need legal services in a way that they haven't needed it before. And just trying to figure out how to match lawyers with the public to sort of help fill that anticipated legal need that I think will be coming.
Is the state bar, does it have any programs specific to lawyers to assist them during this pandemic? And I don't know, is there anything going on sort of behind the scenes that the state bar is working on to assist lawyers as they transition out of this pandemic?
I don't know about specific programs. We're looking at things that, you know, will impact lawyers. For example, CLE reporting requirements, you know, license fee. You know, we've been working with other entities like the PLF, which is our insurance, lawyers, mandatory insurance, malpractice insurance in Oregon. So we're looking at the things that lawyers are going to have to comply with or pay down the line to see what kind of flexibility we can build in to sort of assist them as they're, you know, sort of trying to get back on their feet.
Leoni, I want to ask you a question that I think I know the answer to, but I want to ask it anyway. So you've led the Oregon Minority Lawyers Association. You've had a leadership role, the Oregon Asian Bar Association, and you received the very significant Oregon Women. And you received an award from NAPABA, the National Asian Pacific American Bar Association. Do you think that specialty affinity bars are important and serve an important role in our profession? And if so, why?
I do. You know, obviously I've spent a lot of time working for and in affinity bars. For me, it's just been about building a community. I started practicing law in Salem, Oregon, which we talked about before, for the Oregon state government. And I just felt completely isolated from any community. I also, I learned I passed the bar on September 10th, 2001. The next day, September 11th happened. And, you know, that created a atmosphere and climate, at least in my workspace, that was really uncomfortable when it came to being, you know, an immigrant and a person of color. And so I really needed the affinity bars to build community and support for me. And so that was a really important part of why I was involved in a lot of those affinity bars. It was also a great opportunity for me to just gain skills, you know, like how to plan a CLE, how to talk to Supreme Court justices, to invite them to events, how to run a board meeting, how to, you know, figure out a budget for an organization, how to write a grant. So, you know, my service in those affinity bars taught me a ton of skills that, you know, were really valuable and I wouldn't have gotten, you know, in the Oregon State Bar, you know, because I didn't have the experience or the reputation to get into something like that. But I really used those affinity bars to gain those skills and really just build a huge community that was, you know, vital to me being able to practice law.
Great. Thank you very much, Leonie. And I want to talk about your sort of law firm experience. You know, we're here with Troutman Sanders and our colleagues from Pepper Hamilton. We'll soon merge on July 1. We're in private practice, obviously. So you've been practicing now at Bullard Law, where you're a shareholder, for about 5 years. And you talked a little bit about some of the challenges transitioning from the public sector to the private sector. What was sort of the best advice that you received as you made that transition or as you're practicing in the private sector?
Well, I mean, the best practical advice was from a friend who was already in a firm who told me, like, do your billing every day, because if you don't, you know, you'll never be able to make it up later on. So just the billing aspect was a really practical piece of advice, because, a lot of lawyers have struggled with that. I'd say as a more general piece of advice, understanding, and this came mainly from my colleagues within the firm, just understanding that business aspect, and that, you know, we do have to make our duty to this firm and as a shareholder is that we need to make money for the shareholders. And so, you know, there's lots of things that are good for the firm, and you need to balance that out with the financial aspect of what's good for the firm. You know, that probably sounds like super obvious to people who grew up in a firm. To me, it just wasn't, because of the way I made decisions my entire career. And so, but really understanding that piece was what I needed the most help with.
Well, thank you, Leonie. I'm not sure anybody springs from the womb knowing about the business of law aspect of it. I think it is a challenge. And so, you know, we have a number of attorneys that are listening right now, and maybe some feel a sense of isolation. They might be in a smaller office with not a lot of folks that look and sound like them. And you know, what advice would you give to a junior attorney who is trying to figure out their place in the legal profession, where they fit in?
Yeah, I mean, fit for me is really hard, because I think fit has been used as sort of an excuse to exclude people who are different. So for example, the firm that I clerked at, you know, there was this notion of I didn't fit the stereotype or image of, you know, the type of lawyer they thought, you know, I should be. And, you know, I think that lots of firms understand diversity, they don't understand inclusion, and that's really tied to fit, you know, that whether or not you can fit into the culture here. So I'm really like, I hate that word to start with. But in terms of how to, you know, sort of navigate that, I mean, one of the things that I tell, you know, law students or newer lawyers that I mentor is you get to make the decision about whether or not you fit. Don't let other people make that decision for you. So lots of times people are not applying for jobs because they think it's not the right fit, or, you know, they're making decisions because other people have told them it's not the right fit. And I want people to be empowered to decide, okay, I've decided it's not the right fit. And maybe law isn't the right fit. You know, I've worked with lots of law students who ultimately decided this isn't the right fit. But as long as it's their decision, I think that's really important to be empowered to do that. I also, you know, especially for newer lawyers, like you just lack power to make decisions. Lots of people will sort of, you know, you just don't have a lot of power, especially as a newer lawyer in a firm. If you don't have a book of business, you're at the whim of partners. And so just, you know, be cognizant that that's not forever. Like, that will change once you learn how to be a good lawyer, once you learn how to service clients and have your own clients or matter generation. Those dynamics will change. But just as a new lawyer, the reality is you have very little power and very little leverage. And so that's not you, that's just the way it is. And so if you can make it through that period, you know, it will get better as you get more power. And as you get more power, you can use that power to help other people, you know, to sort of break the cycle that, you know, you were probably stuck in as a newer lawyer. But you have to make it through. And you might have to make some sacrifices to make it through. And again, those are your choices. You can make those sacrifices or not. But if you can do that, it will get better. But it takes time.
Well, I want to ask you one final question before we open it up to the folks that are listening. And it touches upon advice. You know, you've gone through a lot in your career. You've achieved levels of success in the public sector and private sector, the bar leadership. And what advice would you give to a lawyer that he or she individually can undertake to improve the diversity and inclusion of the legal profession?
I guess one piece of advice I would say is, you know, there's no substitute for hard work and being a good lawyer. Like, if you are a good lawyer, an ethical lawyer, a professional lawyer, like, opportunities will happen for you. But if you're not, they won't, you know? And so I think people sort of want that opportunity right away. And it takes time, and it takes time to establish a reputation. And there's just no substitute for the hard work that it takes to be presented with those opportunities. It's really frustrating for people who come from different backgrounds, because I think there is a reality that, do you have a kid? Because I have a cat that's freaking out right here. you know, people see people who have a little bit more privilege and it looks like things are handed to them. But for women and people of color, like, you have to work. Like, there is no substitute for that work. Nothing's gonna be handed to you the same way you might see some of your peers getting handed opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, Leonie. We've appreciated you taking the time to speak to us and the advice and wisdom that you imparted. Now I'd like to see if somebody who is listening in has a question for Leonie Reeves.
I'm going to let my cat out while people are thinking about that.
I have a question. This is Robert Lee in the Atlanta office.
Robert Lee from my firm's Atlanta office has a question. Go ahead, Robert.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking the time today. I was wondering, when you were talking about your background in rural Oregon, and then now leading a statewide organization. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, you've got the urban, the metropolitan Portland area, and then the very rural areas in the eastern part of the state. And so, you know, just, you know, as a, you know, leading the statewide organization as a woman of color, I mean, do you get pushback from the lawyers from the smaller towns, and does that impact, like, does growing up, or, you know, having a significant amount of time, you know, as a kid in rural areas, do you rely on that to converse with them, or just to be able to, you know, not speak their language, but, you know, and just, you know, your own, like, diverse, you know, in every sense of the word, background, like, does that help with those situations, or are they, do you find a lot of pushback from folks who might not necessarily cotton to what you're trying to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for that. So my experience, and, you know, when I was worked for the Attorney General's office, I tried cases all over the state. I tried cases in Portland, and then I tried cases in Vail, which Roman knows where Vail is. It's in a different time zone. You know, it's way in eastern Oregon. Small, tiny counties. And as a lawyer, I have been really pleasantly surprised at how the community has received me. And I think I do have some credibility coming from Coos County. I mean, I think there's a tendency from people who don't understand rural Oregon and the types of situations and economic crises and cultural issues and social issues. People who don't understand that, it's really easy to judge them as being ignorant or being, you know, too whatever. I understand where that comes from. I mean, I really understand why they treated me the way they did. And although I don't appreciate it, and I certainly didn't enjoy it, like, there is a part of me that really understands their pain and can forgive them for that, you know? And so when I was working in the governor's office, for example, we talked a lot about policies that, you know, environmental policies, and the missing from that discussion was, well, why is this such a problem for places like Coos County that was so reliant on logging? And so I do think that part of my background does allow me to connect and have a little bit more credibility with people. Mm-hmm. You know, I also just think inherently people are okay. If they're racist, they're racist, right? Like, you're not gonna, nothing I say or do is gonna get through that. But for people who are willing to have a conversation and talk and, you know, hear my perspective, and the fact that I travel there and hear theirs means a lot. You know, the fact that I actually can leave Portland and go down to Klamath Falls and meet with people. I haven't been able to do that as much as I'd like to because I've been stuck in my house this year as president, but over the last, you know, like several years, I haven't been able to get out, you know, into the community, into rural Oregon. And just the fact that you show up, you know, means a lot to them. And so I will say, you know, the most ironic thing about being a lawyer of color is the prejudice and discrimination I have felt as a lawyer has always come from other lawyers or from a judge. It's not come from a jury, it's not come from my clients, it's not come from the people I'm deposing as opposing counsel, it's come from other lawyers and judges.
Wow. Thank you very much, Liani. I appreciate that. I'm sorry, Robert, were you done with your question?
Well, I mean, I was just saying, wow, that's kind of disheartening in the sense that, you know, other professionals, they're the ones, you know, dealing that out the most. That's got to be frustrating. And so I'm just, you know, I would love to hear more if you want to share any stories about that. But in any event, thank you for that. Thank you for that response.
Yeah, sure. And I'm happy to share a little bit more because I think it's really hard, and it's something that women and people of color struggle with, how to respond, especially if it's a judge and you have no power, really. So I'll give you a couple examples. I tried a case in Jackson County, which is rural southern Oregon, in the circuit court. I had an opposing counsel who spent his entire rebuttal, I was a defendant, so he was a plaintiff, he spent his entire rebuttal telling the jury that he hoped that they didn't believe me because I was pretty. He spent his entire voir dire talking about the fact there was no immigration issue in the case, but that he suspected that Ms. Reeves was an immigrant, and he just wanted the jury to be aware of that. The judge didn't call him on any of that BS behavior, right? And
wow,
sitting there representing a client who, you know, like, I'm personally affronted by all of this, but, you know, like, I think the case is going okay. So, you know, like, I had to make a choice, like, do I call this out? Do I ask for a mistrial? You know, do I, you know, call out the judge for being, you know, not supportive? Whatever. I did nothing, you know. I did nothing because I felt like it was the best for my client that I just proceed and do the best I can. And I'll tell you, the jury came back with a defense verdict in 12 minutes. And so, I mean, that was like, you know, that felt pretty good, right? But, yeah. You know, I spent a lot of the case sort of like with this other stuff I had to deal with. And then I had another case, Marion County, Salem, which is also not particularly diverse, where Willamette is. I had a judge who, during voir dire, one of the jurors wanted to be excused because it was Chinese New Year, Lunar New Year. And the judge took us back in chambers and said, Ms. Reeves, I'm relying on you to tell me, like, is Chinese New Year, like, a real thing? Should I excuse this juror? And I said, well, judge, I don't know. I mean, first of all, I'm Korean. And second of all, I just don't know. And he said, well, it's close enough. So just tell me what you think. Should I do? You know, and so again, like, it's a judge. So I didn't say anything. I didn't call him on it. Unfortunately we lost that case, but we probably deserve to lose. But, you know, I mean, it's just like having to deal with those kind of things is really hard, especially when you don't have a lot of power.
Sure.
And so for me, it's just been, don't let it throw you off your goal, which is to do the best job you can for your client.
Great. Thank you very much, Liani. Are there other questions for Liani before we terminate the interview? Linda.
Yes, I have a quick question. I was thinking about some of the statistics that say that the Asian American population is the fastest growing in general and also within the legal profession. and that the irony is that a lot of, even though there's numerosity, it's not breaking through at the leadership level, at the partnership level, and beyond. And I'm wondering if, from your perspective in Oregon, if that is also what you see, and if you have some thoughts about what causes that.
Yeah, thank you for that. So Justice Goodwin Liu out of, he's on the California Supreme Court now, but he did a study with some Yale law students on the state of Asian Americans in the law called the Portrait Project. And it has, you know, a lot of the statistics that you talked about, Linda, that even though attorneys, Asian American, Pacific American attorneys are statistically the highest number of diverse lawyers in firms, they are least likely to make partner. You know, so there is definitely a trajectory issue. There's a leadership issue. There's a retention issue for API and a disproportionate number of lawyers and graduates and new lawyers as opposed to people who reach leadership. You know, it's a complicated issue for me because a lot of the Portrait Project sort of study talks about the cultural reasons why lawyers from API backgrounds may have problems excelling just because of their own cultural barriers from their upbringing. You know, like that doesn't make any sense to me because I was raised white. I mean, I will just say I was raised white. I have none of that cultural Asian identity, but I am treated exactly the same. I am treated as though people assume that I do. And so going back to that situation where I clerked at a firm and they had this perception of me that I was passive. I mean, they were portraying on me sort of this cultural stereotype that I don't identify with at all. And I just don't have it, you know? And so there is definitely that perception of API lawyers, of API women in particular, even more, that they just possess certain qualities that don't allow them to advance. And so, you know, lots of statistics around the bamboo ceiling and why API lawyers don't advance. And for me, the interesting part is like, I don't think it's an internal cultural issue because I don't have that. I think it's an external cultural societal stereotype that is placed on API lawyers just as much as maybe there's some internal stuff. But really it's like people just look at you and see an Asian face and they make all of these assumptions about it, regardless of whether that's true. And I really think that is a real barrier for a lot of Asian Pacific American attorneys.
Thank you very much, Liani. We have time for one more question, if anybody has a final question for Liani Reeves.
Hi, this is Kasim Lucas from Pepper Hamilton. Thank you so much, Ms. Reeves, for your conversation today. I found it to be fantastic.
Thank you.
And my question goes to the audience to receive messages such as yours. And I also serve as a partner in charge of diversity at Pepper. And one of the frustrating things I find is often good conversations like these are being heard by a select few, and those few are generally other people of color, people who are involved in the diversity committee and such. And one of the things I think we all need to do more is get this message out to others, particularly those who are, you know, in power at law firms or general counsel and so on and so forth. And I must say everyone, you know, generally has a great understanding that diversity is important, but I don't think we have enough people out there learning what are the experiences of others, what things that they can do to change. And finally, my question is, what have you done, thought about, either as head of the bar or in your law firm, to get others who need to hear the message involved in the conversation in order to affect change?
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, Ramon's questions earlier about why I chose to go into leadership for the Oregon State Bar speaks a lot to this point. I mean, I had a great time in the affinity bars and, you know, got to talk about these issues, got to do programs that were important to me and my community, but it was for my community in my community. It wasn't necessarily educating others about the issues that my community faced. And so the Oregon State Bar for me was really an opportunity and a venue where I would have a larger audience, you know, that it wasn't just people who looked and thought like me. It wasn't just people with my values and my experience. And I could really use that position to educate other people about my experience as a woman of color, other people's experiences as immigrants or minorities or whatever. It just allowed me a broader audience. And so one of the, I don't know if you were alluding to this article in particular, but my opening column for the Oregon State Bar when I took presidency, they did a story on me. And, you know, most bar president stories are pretty professionally based about, you know, your experiences as a lawyer. I was very strategic about having an article about me that was really focused on my experience as a woman of color and as an immigrant and as an orphan and, you know, things that really didn't have to do with my professional identity, but my personal identity, because I knew that I would have an audience of 14,000 lawyers. You know, not everybody reads the bar bulletin, fine, but you know, it was just an opportunity for me to educate a much broader audience and to bring my message and my perspective to a group that didn't already have it. And so looking for leadership opportunities like that, where your audience, you force your audience to be different and bigger or just different, even though it's super uncomfortable, was really strategic for me. And as I've been president, you know, I've tried to have some messages that are really more about my experience personally than professionally, just so that I have this platform that I can use this year where people who are coming from different perspectives kind of have to listen to me because I'm the bar president. So, you know, I'm going to use that position and power a little bit to make sure people understand that my story is different and that there's lots of people with different stories.
Thank you very much, Liani. Well, we want to be respectful of your time. We asked you to block out an hour, which we've done. On behalf of both firms, Troutman Sanders and Pepper Hamilton, we want to thank you for taking the time. We found it very enriching and rewarding to listen to you. So thank you very much, Liani. I appreciate it.
Well, yeah, thank you. And I really want to thank you for inviting me and for celebrating APA Heritage Month. I also want to thank you for bringing lawyers together during this pandemic time when people are all stuck in their homes. I mean, I think that there's a real sense of isolation and grief and loss of power and control in this current situation, and having opportunities like this to interact with other people and like have human connection is really important. So thank you for your firms, your two respective firms continuing to do that.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Leon. The pleasure was ours.
Thank you
very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.